Hi everyone, I'm your host NG, and welcome to the 60th episode of the podcast, Sounds About Right, Audiobooks Help Us Understand the World. And on this episode, I was joined by Bart Elmore, author of the book Country Capitalism, How Corporations from the American South Remade Our Economy and the Planet. And in the book, Bart uses the histories of five Southern firms, Coca-Cola, Delta Airlines, Walmart, FedEx, and Bank of America, to investigate the environmental impact of our have-it-now, fly-by-night, buy-on-credit economy. He explores the historical, economic, and ecological conditions that gave rise to these five trailblazing corporations. And he then considers what each has become, an essential presence on the daily workings of the global economy and an unmistakable contributor to the reshaping of the world's ecosystems. It was great to discuss the book with Bart, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. So the first thing I want to ask you actually is, how did you go about choosing the five companies that you examined in the book?
I think the answer to that is in part personal. You know, I grew up in the American South and grew up in Atlanta, which was a town that was booming. I was born in 81. So, you know, 90s, it was exploding. The Olympics came in 1996. I remember that very well. Just, whoa, like we have the Olympics here. Coca-Cola was in my backyard, which is featured in the book. Delta Airlines, also featured in the book, was the largest airline in the world coming out of the South. I'd left the South to go to school, and I'd looked back at the region in a way with fresh eyes. I had had conversations with people that gave me the impression that there was this kind of image of the American South as being an agricultural economy, which in part is true. But often these firms that are in the book were kind of missing from those conversations. I then went off to graduate school at the University of Virginia, started studying the history of economic history of the American South. And once again, I noticed that, like, even in the literature, even textbooks, that businesses like Delta and others got kind of short shrift. So I think the selection of these five firms, and it was Coca-Cola, Delta Airlines, Walmart, FedEx, and Bank of America, came from my own kind of mastery of the field of economic history of the American South and recognizing that these businesses weren't part of the story. So last thing I'll say is, to me, they all kind of came together in stories about logistics, whether it was we're talking about retail or finance, or, you know, in the case of FedEx, kind of just managing these air express delivery systems. To me, we don't think of the American South as the center of kind of logistical revolution, but in fact, it was. And so these five companies that I mentioned, I think, helped tell that story.
And what were the things in the book regarding the five companies that you wanted to examine, Bart?
You know, at first I wasn't quite sure. I was given quite a long leash to write this book. The University of North Carolina Press actually reached out to me and said, hey, we'd love for you to write on kind of anything you're interested in. And what a gift in a way to do that. So I started looking at companies. There were a lot of firms that didn't make the list, you know, some like Kentucky Fried Chicken, which we were talking about London. I've spent time there. And I remember, you know, here's another Southern company that has quite a global reach. And yet, for me, there had been great writing about the poultry industry in the American South. There had been writing about things like chicken processing and things like this. And so I want to acknowledge that this is only part of the story, that there's this whole other economy that I think has gotten a lot of attention. But I wanted to kind of steer clear of some of those more extractive and kind of more ag-based businesses and to think a little bit about these other firms in the story. And I didn't know what I was going to see when I started looking at all these companies. And I didn't try and cherry pick. I mean, in each of these industries, these are the biggest brands you can think of. Coca-Cola, one of the biggest brands in the world. Walmart, the largest corporation on the planet. I mean, this needs explaining. How the heck did it start in Bentonville, Arkansas, a little town of a few thousand people? These were the questions that kind of motivated me. But over time, what I came to see is that, you know, they were all kind of linked. That all of them in some way were, I think, critical in shaping the, quote, Amazon economy that we think of today. The Swiss delivery of goods overnight to people. That in fact, that had a story that related to the American South. Just to tick off a couple, you know, Delta Airlines inventing in many ways in 1955 for the commercial aviation industry, the hub and spoke model, which drives most of us crazy. We have to fly into this central airport and fly out. Delta Airlines, which started as a crop dusting company in the American South, pilots this. And then guess what? FedEx, a company in the 1970s based in Memphis, Tennessee, says, oh, this is smart. Well, what if we did that hub and spoke model for packaging overnight and revolutionized that system? Walmart, of course, another one that's, you know, we think of the swift delivery of goods across the country going to the smallest little towns. What was unique about Walmart, they were going into towns of 2,000, 3,000 people and putting huge 100, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of square feet of goods in these places and figuring out that you can make a profit. Turns out that Jeff Bezos, years later, creates Amazon. He flies to Bentonville. He reads Sam Walton's biography. You know, he is inspired by this thing that's happening in the American South to create this revolution that comes down the road. So I guess the long takeaway here is that the rural roads to our Amazon economy, I think, went through the American South in ways that we never fully acknowledge. And I think this book tries to show those connections.
Absolutely. You make a very nice summary near the end of how Bezos said Amazon was more or less able to flourish because there was a lot of systems that were already there, essentially, that would, had they have not been, have taken him billions as well as years to have done, essentially, before Amazon could actually be a company running.
It's interesting when you read Jeff Bezos's writing, and I thank you for highlighting that, NG. You know, it's always great, by the way, to talk with people who've actually read the book or heard the book closely. You know, that to me was really striking. I went back to Bezos's writings, and that's what kept jumping out to me. He was acknowledging this in his own writing. I mean, he went to Bentonville. He hired much of his staff to help to build out this distribution system from Bentonville. Who ran his one of his first warehouses out in the Pacific Northwest? Well, a guy from FedEx. It turns out that these companies, it wasn't just a kind of a connection, but in fact, there was a direct connection between these firms and what Bezos did. And it is interesting because I think we think of Bezos today as, I don't know what people think of him, but, you know, he is building a spaceship that he flies on with his friends, kind of an arrogant at times, kind of let's go do it. Anything's possible. I can make it all happen. And yet in his writings, I mean, he's actually pretty, he acknowledges, like, I built this on top of so many other businesses, including Bank of America's credit card, you know, which Bank of America was the first commercial bank in the United States to really issue these big credit cards in 1955. So I think all of these things are, you know, unpacking this story of it's not just the genius of tech in Silicon Valley that makes our economy work. In fact, it's the nuts and bolts of distribution and logistics that in some ways came out of the American South.
So why did you use the term commercial ecology in the book?
That's a great find because it was a friend of mine who actually brought this up, and to give him a plug, Stephen Massacura, another fabulous environmental historian at the University of Indiana here in the United States. He writes about NGOs and World Wildlife Fund, among others, and thinking about the impacts of these organizations and written great books. But anyway, you sit down as you do as a historian and talk to your friends. And I wanted a term that was more, I guess, expansive than just the environment of the South, because I don't think this book is trying to say that it's just the natural environment that explains why these businesses emerged where they did, even though I think that's a big part of the story. I think there are also politics and culture, the commercial ecology, as it were, this broader umbrella of things that explains why Walmart was able to emerge when it did. And that includes, you know, like the lax labor laws that allowed them to pay workers very low wages in many ways to make all this possible in the American South. Lax environmental regulations that allowed them to not have to deal with a lot of expenses. But yeah, there were actual physical, natural, environmental things too. Like, why was FedEx in Memphis, Tennessee? You know, it turns out, as you know from having listened to it, that there is an ecological, natural environment story. Fred Smith, who ran FedEx, started it in 1971, started in Memphis because he wanted to have an airport that was far enough south from, say, Chicago to not have to deal with all those snowstorms. If you ever fly in on a snowy day, as I do up here in the Midwest, it's not fun flying. But to also be far enough north of the hurricanes and tropical storms of the Gulf of Mexico, and also to be in the center of what he called the small package market. You already had airlines going to LA and to New York over that, which, you know, sometimes overnight you could ship goods that way. But what he was doing was finding these smaller markets in the middle of the country, a market that was being basically ignored, much like Walmart was doing in Bentonville, you know, looking at these small towns in middle America and saying, you know what, I bet you there's a lot of business here. And then it turns out once you do that, once you figure out how to get goods into those smaller markets, well, wow, you're developing some pretty sophisticated logistics systems that other people are going to fix. That's why the book is called Country Capitalism. You know, it turns out that the countryside, which we think of as like maybe in the antithesis of capitalism in a way, you know, it's like the place where industrial innovation goes to die. Well, it turns out, though, it's actually where we develop some of the most sophisticated computer systems and logistics systems of our time. So these were all surprising, but I think the natural environment mattered in each of these stories.
And how did government spending have so much of an impact with how these companies grew so big, Bart?
You know, I wrote a book before this called Citizen Coke, The Making of Coca-Cola Capitalism, that looked at the history of Coca-Cola. It took me about 7 to 8 years to write. And, you know, as one does as a historian, you dive deep, you get really into it. In that book, I looked at each ingredient that went into Coca-Cola and talked about how was it that Coke was able to get all these resources at such low cost. And it was then, NG, that I first saw this theme that you see in this book years ago, that it turns out the government at every turn was so essential to the rise of many of these firms, despite the fact that many of their leaders would often lambast the government, say, we don't want you off our back. We don't want you to get out of our business because we're in business and we don't need the government. Well, it turns out history suggests otherwise. You know, in the case of Coca-Cola, just the investment in public infrastructure, think about water in the United States. 80% of what the company was selling is coming from public tap water that was invested in by municipalities, including in Atlanta, millions of dollars spent on this. And then that public good becomes packaged in a private product and makes them a lot of money. You know, you think about companies like Delta Airlines in the story that benefits from programs like the Essential Air Service program. These little programs we never think about if you're flying in the United States. But we're a vast country with a lot of rural airports. And if you fly into some of these towns, you say, well, wait a minute, this plane is not full. You know, it's maybe 30% capacity. Well, it turns out there's a federal program here in the United States that pays to basically subsidize those flights to make sure that you can have smaller airports and smaller communities. Now, I'm not here to debate the pros and cons of that. I mean, some would say that's good. You know, smaller towns actually have access to air travel that otherwise wouldn't. But what's left unsaid is that Delta benefits from this, you know, and so do the other major airlines who otherwise would not be able to feed, you know, people from small towns like Muscle Shoals into Atlanta and then out to the world. So back to that hub and spoke model. So at every turn, you can kind of see the government at place here. I'll mention one other thing about Delta. And again, just for anyone who flies Delta Airlines, and I'm talking, I know, to folks in a global community, it's named Delta because of the Mississippi Delta. This is where it got its start. It was a crop dusting firm spraying chemicals over cotton fields in the American South. That's how it became a big commercial aviation enterprise. So that's why you see that Delta name. It represents the ecology, the environment of the American South where it grew out of. But, you know, you think about an airline like this and the subsidies it got. It also got subsidies during the Jim Crow era in the American South. You know, this is a period of intense segregation, the kind of dehumanizing laws that Black Americans faced in the American South. And yet the federal government was providing funds to southern cities like Atlanta, Greensboro, and others to build out their airports, even though it seemed to be violating constitutional rights of Black Americans that were being segregated in these institutions. So one of the interesting things I talk about is how the federal government could have taken a stance and said, you know what, we're not going to give you money, Atlanta, unless you actually treat all your citizens equally. But they didn't. They allowed for federal money to be used to create segregated terminals And this was building off a great book on the history of Jim Crow and airports in the American South. But it's interesting, you see at every turn kind of federal dollars shaping this. And yet the owner's saying, we don't want anything with the government. We hate the government. Well, in fact, they're products of it in many ways.
What were the ecological issues as a result of Delta's growth, Bart?
You know, for Delta, I think their story was a lot about jet fuel. And I have to say, I was recently on a panel with some of the leading folks at GE and others who are developing the new turbines. And are we going to be able to electrify our aircraft? What was kind of, scary to being in that room with all these folks who know this is just how hard it is to get these big commercial planes to be truly planes that don't run on fossil fuels. So I don't know what the answer really is here, but one of the things I try and point out in that chapter was how efficiency became the watchword of the aviation industry, especially in the 1970s when the energy crisis hit. Delta began buying much more energy efficient aircraft, saying, okay, we're really facing a problem. Our energy costs are going up and up and up as the oil prices go up, and we're going to develop new planes that can use fuel more efficiently. What we see in that chapter is what historians call the classic case of Jevons paradox. And Jevons paradox is named after an economist from the 1860s, from the great land of England. He was writing about coal in the 1860s, and this industrial revolution that was taking hold in English cities and other places. And he said, look, it turns out that if we create technologies that can more efficiently use coal, we might think that we're going to reduce our consumption of coal. But in fact, what we're doing is incentivizing the use of coal. We're making it more profitable to use coal. And in the long run, we're going to see this explosion in the consumption of coal. And we see that with Delta, that they have this moment where they're getting more efficient planes, which means they can use fuel more efficiently and therefore, you know, less expensively. But then over time, that means they can expand their fleet and expand their operations. And then in the long run, they use much more fuel. So one of the things I'm trying to point out to sustainability experts inside of companies, and I think this book is directed to them, is to say, watch out for words like efficiency. They can sometimes be a distraction from the hard work of investing in totally radical new ideas of how you're going to propel these planes. And I think it's one of the reasons that we're so far behind in aviation. You know, we're just going to keep using jet fuel, and we're just going to, you know, think of efficiency as our best mechanism for dealing with this, instead of, you know, spending for decades bigger R&D dollars on, you know, totally new engines. Delta ended up being, by 2012, by the way, the largest consumer of jet fuel in the United States. And it ended up owning its own jet fuel refinery, which shows you how embedded they are in the fossil fuel industry. They actually refine their own jet fuel. And I try and point that out as well, the conflict of interest as airlines try and become carbon neutral when they're actually in the oil business themselves. So these are all things I think that are food for thought in that chapter.
Is it fair to say that making a statement along the lines of banks don't contribute towards commercial ecology misguided?
Yes, I would say so. But what was surprising, NG, was going back and trying to figure out, when did banks become the target of environmental activism? And it turns out that it was relatively late. And I think for listeners who aren't from the U.S., this might be surprising. In the U.S., for most of our history, interstate banking, that is, banks having branches in multiple states, was essentially prohibited under federal law. You could not have, say, a Bank of America branch in California and in Oklahoma for much of the 20th century. You could only be in California, which is where they started. That changed radically in the 1980s and 1990s in the United States, where commercial banks could branch out and have interstate branches due to new laws that relaxed and those branching restrictions. What happened as a result is that banks that used to have hundreds of billions of dollars in assets ended up having trillions of dollars in assets. The banks consolidated over time. We also saw changes in the law that allowed investment banks and commercial banks to merge in many ways after 1999 and the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. And so the power of banks in the United States, of a handful of banks, became enormous. And I think that's when we see, in the early 2000s, folks like the Rainforest Action Network, the Sierra Club, and others begin the first big commercial bank campaigns to say, you know, enough about protesting this chemical plant or whatever. Let's go after the big dollars and see if we can shut off the flow of that capital before it gets to the polluting problem in the first place. And so I think you're right to say that is misguided because now in the U.S., some of our more radical environmental legislation is centered on the financial sector, changing loan portfolios. The president, Biden, has just passed an executive order asking the Treasury Department to investigate climate risk in our financial system, to adjust the Dodd-Frank Act to say, okay, can we change our banking regulations, not just to outlaw predatory lending that we think is harmful to our, you know, to people, but what about climate? And can we embed new rules that change that game? I think it's an exciting time. If you can move trillions of dollars in assets one way or the other, wow, can we move on climate change much more fast than going after every little polluting plant, you know, that's out there? I'm hopeful and optimistic in a way because of these new developments.
So why has the Bank of America been credited as a sustainability leader, as well as dubbed the Bank of Coal? But
yeah, I think it goes to the fact that a lot of this over the last 20 years, companies have had a long leash, as it were, to establish what sustainability means. Around 2007, 8, 9, we started seeing the emergence of what we call environmental and social and governance standards, or ESG. And this has become a hot topic now in the US as people debate whether ESG is useful or not. What I will say about that history is that in many ways, ESG was designed to be controlled by private enterprises and to kind of keep government, back to our earlier conversation, out of this, to let private industry kind of voluntarily develop systems and develop a shareholder culture that would motivate them to do the good things on the environment. The problem, looking back at this as a historian, and I'm data-based, I try to take my own politics, you know, as much as I can and put those to the side and say, okay, what can we see from the past? And the data is startling. A recent study of some of the top companies in the United States came out with Bain Consulting Company. I think it was a 2019 study, looked at the sustainability promises of businesses and the success rate that they've had at meeting those targets. And if you had to guess, you'd probably guess, you know, well, let's see, how successful were they? Maybe 50%, maybe. It turns out that they found that there was a 4% success rate, a 4% success rate when it came to businesses meeting their sustainability targets. So it goes back to what you said, which is on paper, there's a lot of things that these banks are doing. And by the way, I've met some of these people inside the company. I also think they're trying to do good things. They think they're doing good things. And sometimes they can convince themselves that, hey, all is well. But looking from the outside at a 4% success rate, you can see the need for stronger pressures and rules, I think, that would force businesses to actually be true to the things that they're saying. I think that's the biggest message I found, not only in writing this book, but all the books I've written over the last two decades on the history of businesses is, you know, without firm rules to say, here's the standard and you need to meet it, you can see this kind of half-ass, you know, result, which is not really getting to where we need to be, especially in an era where the IPCC and the United Nations, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is saying, we got to act now. We've really got to change course to deal with these things. So I'm hopeful, again, that we'll see less of this culture of letting businesses kind of run the show to saying, here's a rule, meet it. And by the way, I think that's a pro-business stance. I think it suggests that I believe that innovation will come. I've seen it even in this story of where a law will be passed. And guess what? The businesses adjust, innovate. But as long as they're not forced to, in many cases, it's business as usual. And so some of the things that might look good, hey, we're investing in solar panels. But when you compare those numbers to how much money they're investing in fossil fuels, it's hard to say, hey, you're on the right course.
Finally, do you think there will be further urbanization of the southern landscape, or has this time passed?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to ask, what is the place of the American South in the 21st century? And I should be careful to note that when I'm writing this, you know, as somebody who grew up in the American South, I'm writing it as somebody who's not necessarily saying, rah, 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 look at my birthplace and how cool it is. I think, as you know, from listening to this, in many ways, it's kind of an indictment of an economy that in so many ways cared less about the people and the planet that are so essential to the running of this economy than to that bottom line and the profits involved. And trying to point out how we can make interventions that could change the game dramatically. I think that also involves us as customers and consumers. I tried, as you see in the intro to the book, to say, I'm not trying to say I'm not a part of this, you know? I click on the Amazon link just like everybody else out there does. This is the world we live in. My expectation, especially living in Columbus that has a Amazon hub here, is to get it maybe within 24 hours. I think I got to confront that myself as a consumer. If indeed changing the planet means recognizing that this overnight, you know, 24-hour delivery system is something totally radically, historically significant and anomalous from the past, we ourselves might have to confront our expectations for how we consume and what that might mean. If new rules might, for example, mean that we get things in 3 days, well, I don't know. Now, so I hear people saying, oh, no, we're going back to the Stone Age. There's that environmental historian saying that. Well, I don't think that has to be the case, but I do think we have to kind of confront the fact that we have pretty outrageous expectations of immediate consumption. And if we want to be part of the solution, we might want to be part of saying, oh, maybe I don't need that product so fast, if indeed it helps the planet in the long run. So I think this is a book not just for businesses and the sustainability leaders in it, but for us as well to kind of think about our place in this society as well.
That was Bart Elmore, author of the book Country Capitalism, How Corporations from the American South Remade Our Economy and the Planet. The book and audiobook is available now, which I do recommend you to pick up and read or to give a listen to. A big thank you to Bart for coming on the podcast, and thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate the podcast and check out some of the previous ones if you haven't done already. And until then, I'll catch you on the next.